This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, actor and writer Sacha Baron Cohen, is famous for taking his characters into the real world and interacting with people who have no idea they're dealing with a fictitious character. He's done it with his characters Ali G, a hip-hop wannabe and clueless TV interviewer, Borat, a misogynistic, anti-Semitic, and all-around clueless man from Kazakhstan, and Bruno, an Austrian gay fashion reporter who comes to America and is, of course, clueless and incredibly inappropriate. But Baron Cohen's new movie, The Dictator, is scripted. He plays General Aladdin, the tyrannical ruler of the fictitious North African country Wadia, who's trying to build a nuclear weapon. NATO's threatened his country with airstrikes unless he addresses the UN in person, which is what brings Aladdin to the U.S. Terry spoke with Sacha Baron Cohen last week and began with a scene from The Dictator, wherein Aladdin, having been secretly deposed and replaced by a body double, is on his own and, of course, clueless in Manhattan. So he's taken a job at a health food store run by an environmentally dedicated young feminist played by Anna Faris. Here they are, right after she's hired him. And parents, some of Baron Cohen's humor is adult.
Anyway, let me give you the grand tour. Up on the roof, we've got this amazing organic garden.
And... Boring. Do you sell any assault rifles?
Oh, wait. I got it. Humor, right? I took a feminist clown workshop once.
Help, help. I'm trapped under a glass ceiling.
I wasn't the best student, but...
You seem educated.
Yes, I went to Amherst.
I love it when women go to school. It's like seeing a monkey on roller skates. It means nothing to them, but it's so adorable for us.
Sacha Baron Cohen, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thank you for having me back, Terry.
So why did you want your next character to be a Middle Eastern dictator?
Well, I'll qualify that firstly and say he's a North African dictator. Because they are dictators, are ludicrous characters. And, you know, in my career and in my life, I've always enjoyed sort of inhabiting these ludicrous, larger-than-life characters that somehow exist in the real world. And just looking around, you know, over the last 10 years in particular, I kind of became obsessed with Colonel Gaddafi, amongst others. But Gaddafi in particular, because he was... so over the top, you know, his dress style was so flamboyant, so ridiculous. In fact, it could only really get to that level of absurdity by the fact that he was somebody who was unquestioned. You know, it's a bit like when you walk around Los Angeles and you see some of these stars dressed in a peculiar way. The reason they're dressed like that is that no one actually questions them, you know. And obviously these dictators become unquestionable and therefore ridiculous, and they become more and more extreme. So Gaddafi with his Virgin Guards, he organized these orgies with Berlusconi. He, you know, is notorious for breaking wind furiously various BBC interviews. Yeah.
Do they edit that out or do they leave that in?
They did a little piece on it. Actually, because after he did the interview, they noticed that he was breaking wind, not only breaking wind, but sort of raising himself up before breaking wind in a kind of proud moment of defiance of Western journalistic standards. He was a kind of ludicrous character that I thought, wow, he's a good inspiration. And then I sort of mixed that in with a kind of older character I had and took bits and bobs from sort of other dictators.
Now, one of the things you stay away from in The Dictator is religion. We don't know if this dictator is Muslim. There's no mention of Islam. There's no mention of the Prophet Muhammad. And that's a good thing, I think, because I don't think it's... I mean, Muslims are very offended by anything that parodies the religion, but also especially it's considered sacrilege to, you know, parody in any way the Prophet. Did you intentionally try to avoid that so as not to be misunderstood, so as not to insult people who you had no interest in insulting?
Exactly. I mean, firstly, again, he's not an Arab dictator, and he actually says that he isn't in the movie. And so we wanted to really ensure that he was not Arabic in any way. So we created a new language, Well, I say that, but he actually speaks at times in Hebrew,
like
which would be strange
did.
For an which would be strange for an Arabic dictator. And we created a new alphabet, which was actually a form of Manchu, which is a dialect, Chinese dialect. And we wanted to make sure the architecture was, you know, not exactly Arabic as well. So we wanted it to be Arabesque, but have the influences of Africa and other dictatorships as well. And in terms of the religion, yeah, you know, he's not a Muslim. His religion is himself. You know, he's turned himself into a demigod. You know, and also we wanted to really make it clear, particularly after the Arab Spring, that this was in no way a parody of Arabs. This was a parody of people who oppress Arabs and people who oppress other people around the world. So that was kind of really crucial, you know, for me to, you know, put out there to show that, you know, that we do support, you know, the rights of people to be free, whatever their religion.
So you mentioned that the language that you're speaking in some of this is actually Hebrew. You come up with a word, and I don't know if this is a Hebrew word or a made-up word, for the female genitals, which is something like maluch?
Malawach?
Yeah.
Malawach is actually I think it's a fried bread, which you can order in any Yemenite restaurant.
Okay, and you chose that because...
Well, it was just easy to remember because I actually really enjoy eating malawach. And I mean the Yemenite bread. I feel I've somehow dug a hole. Anyway, you know what I mean. But I do enjoy I do enjoy Yemenite cuisine. And that's not a euphemism.
So this is the first time that you have a character who comes to America and it's scripted. You know, Bruno's come to America, Ali G's come to America, Borat's come to America, but that has been your character coming and actually talking to real people who didn't know who the characters were and didn't know that they were, you know, made-up characters. So what are some of the differences for you? First of all, why did you do this as a scripted film? My assumption would be because it was unsafe to do it any other way at this point, between how famous you are now, more people are in on the joke, lawsuits, you've risked your life in other films for the joke. So I assume that's among the reasons why this one's scripted.
That's it. And the biggest one was a creative one. We actually just thought we could make a better movie if it had a script and, you know, didn't involve real people. I think pulling off a kind of fake documentary of me being a actual dictator would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, because, you know, we got away with it on Borat because Kazakhstan was a real country. So you could say I'm from Kazakhstan National Television and people would look up Kazakhstan and it existed. But if I came this time and said I'm from Wadia, they'd, you know, look it up and realize it didn't exist. And if I said, listen, I'm the dictator of Turkmenistan or, you know, or Libya, they could look it up on Wikipedia and realize that I'm not. So it would have been impossible to, you know, have this real story. And also we wanted to have a love story in it because, you know, it's really the transformation of, you know, this dictator becomes humanized. You know, he's inhuman, he's amoral at the beginning, and he does change a little bit over time. So we knew we needed a woman to do that. In Bruno's case, it was a man, but in this case, we knew that we needed somebody to transform him a little bit, and that would have been impossible in a non-scripted film.
So
it had got extremely dangerous. Bruno, I remember towards the end, you know, we loved the experience, but I did say to the team, you know, at some point we've got to stop because you can only be so lucky, and we'd been incredibly lucky by, you know, no one had been seriously injured. You know, I broke my foot, but that was about it. I broke my foot and my thumb. That was about it. But we were very close a lot of times to, you know, sustaining real injuries. And not just me, the crew as well. You know, there was a lot of kind of very violent situations, and we were antagonizing a lot of people who were armed, which we hadn't really dealt with in Borat. But with Bruno, we felt that because he was sort of more of an unlikable figure in a way, that you would have to put him in slightly more dangerous situations and situations of homophobia, you know. And in a lot of places where we were dealing with homophobes, a lot of those guys were armed. And so it became, you know, we were very lucky that there wasn't really a problem.
I remember you talking about you breaking your thumb. What happened to your foot?
Well, okay, this is what happened to my foot. I was in Kansas. There's a scene in Bruno where I am wearing S&M gear and I'm chained up to my boyfriend. We were shooting it in this hotel room and we like called up room service, and the guy comes in room service and the room is in a despicable state. There are animals in certain drawers. And it looks pretty disgusting. And me and my boyfriend are, you know, semi-naked in S&M gear, tied up together. And, you know, I'm saying, do you mind, you know, can you give us the room? Do you mind untraining us? You know. And basically the guy called the police. And we were in Kansas. We'd had some problems with the police beforehand. And the local police had decided that they wanted to arrest me. And they'd warned us beforehand if we did anything in Kansas, they'd arrest us. Because I'd just done this scene with a group called rather unpleasant and offensive name of God Hates Fags, who are run by the Phelps family. And they are the people who protest at the funerals of soldiers who've returned from Iraq. They're quite a despicable group. And so I had done some stuff to slightly antagonize them. I'd shot a scene with them, and the police had kind of warned me that they'd come and arrest me. So this guy, back to the hotel room, the room service guy brought up the manager. The manager called the police. And so we knew we had about 5 minutes to get out of the hotel before the police turned up, and then I'd be arrested. So I was chained to my co-star, and we had an English bodyguard. This guy said, all right, let's go. Come on, everybody out. Everybody out. And me and my co-star start running down the corridor. And we went towards the elevator. And we've got we always have like an escape car waiting. A getaway car. It's like any good heist. And so the getaway car's waiting 14 stories down in the alleyway. And so we get to the elevator, and the elevator's closing, and then suddenly the hotel security stopped the elevator from closing. And so we have to run out of the elevator, and we start running down the stairs. And basically, the bodyguard gets his and his earpiece. The police are downstairs waiting for me. And so he says, all right, follow me. And we start running, you know, down this corridor, and you see, like, other hotel guests looking at us. And he's taken, I go, where are we going? He goes, just follow me. And we get to the end of the corridor, to the window, and he lifts open the window. And I said, why are you doing that? He says, get out the window, jump out. So I look outside the window, and we're 14 stories up, and it's a building from, I think, 1910. And there's an old rickety fire escape there. And so he said, come on, go, the police are going to get you, come on. So we start running down this rickety fire escape, 14 stories up. We get down to the second floor, and as with a lot of these old fire escapes, they don't reach the floor. So we're two stories up, and the getaway car is, you know, I can see the getaway car. And I said, how do we get down? He goes, jump. And so I jumped wearing these high heels while I was still attached to my friend. And broke my heel, and then, you know, got in the car, and we kind of we left the state, because that was always the rule, which was, you know, those police, if there's ever a warrant for your arrest, they've only got jurisdiction in the state. So, but when I got back to the hotel, I filmed another day, and then I realized there was something wrong with my foot, and it had been cracked. The heel had been cracked.
That sounds really horrible. And it reminds me of something that Jerry Seinfeld was quoted as saying in the New York Times in an article.
Was he in S&M gear as well? Or?
That's not what he was saying.
No.
What he was saying was he thinks that your comedy comes from a place of courage and his comes from a place of fear. but you really have to be brave to do, and maybe crazy, to
I don't know if
take
I'm
those
brave.
Kinds of chances.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm brave. I think in the moment. So when I'm in character, I'm in character. And I'm obviously thinking about what's going on around me, but it's easier to do stuff when you're in character.
The movie is scripted, but in promoting the movie, you did things that were just in character. And this was really hysterical. When the Academy Award people, I guess it's the National Academy of Arts and Sciences?
Yes.
When you were told that you couldn't show up in character for the red carpet, you did a really hysterical video in character in your full dictator regalia with your virgin bodyguards protecting you. And I'm going to play the clip of, we'll just hear the audio of that video that you did.
Good morning, great Satan of America. How are you? I am fine, thank you. On behalf of the nation of Wadia, I am outraged at being banned from the Oscars by the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Zionists. While I applaud the Academy for taking away my right to free speech, I warn you that if you do not lift your sanctions and give me my tickets back by 12 p.m. on Sunday, you will face unimaginable consequences. Furthermore, it is an act of aggression that no Wadian films have been recognized by the Academy. Where are the nominations for such classic films as When Harry Kidnapped Sally, You've Got Mail Bomb, or Planet of the Rapes? On top of all of this, I paid Hilary Swank $2 million to be my date, and she will not refund a penny. My Sunday calendar is now as empty as a North Korean grocery store. But whatever happens, I still plan to attend director Brett Ratner's after party, since it's impossible to catch herpes twice. Death to the West, death to America, and good luck, Billy Crystals. You're fantastic. How was that? Did I sound crazy enough?
That's Sacha Baron Cohen in character as the dictator after he was banned from the Oscars. Why were you banned in character?
I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you why I was invited. I was invited to the Oscars originally because I did this movie, Hugo, with Martin Scorsese, and the movie got nominated for a few awards. And so I think it was quite an unprecedented thing that the Academy essentially banned me from coming with a beard on. And
this was to the red carpet and to the Oscars?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was not allowed to come. So
could you have come as yourself or just not come in character?
They said I could come as myself, yes. But the dictator was not to be dictated to. So, but the head of the Academy called up my agent and threatened him. And it became kind of like a, you know, semi kind of mafia-like threat of, you know, if I turned up within half a mile off the Oscars, he said that I would be arrested by one of the 250 plainclothes FBI officers that were, you know, under his command, which kind of was ludicrous. And then, you know, everyone who knew me was being, you know, called up telling, you know, saying, convince Sasha not to turn up. This is, you know, he's taken it too far now. This is the Academy Awards. It's one thing taking the mick out of terrorists, but, you know, doing it out of the Academy Awards, that really is. He's gone too far now. So, yeah, they reach Martin Scorsese. They, you know, they try to get everyone to prevent me, you know, to turn up. They called the studio. They said that there would be repercussions for my career in Hollywood. There'd be repercussions for the film, Hugo. And so I issued that statement.
Well, you used the opportunity to release like a really funny video, which ended up promoting the film very effectively. But you defied the Academy. You actually showed up in character as the dictator on the red carpet. How did you decide to defy them?
Well, they actually capitulated. I mean, I put that video out saying that they had until 12 o'clock. And it was obviously a kind of jokey threat, but they actually gave in and they handed me back my two tickets.
Okay, so what you did was you were talking to Ryan Seacrest, who is doing, you know, the red carpet stuff and, you know, broadcasting from the red carpet, and he was interviewing you, and you explained that you had Kim Jong-il's ashes in the urn and that, like, oops, you accidentally spilled them all over his beautiful tuxedo jacket. And I think you've explained that the quote, ashes were actually flour, you know, baking flour.
Yes, it was flour. And I was showing him that the irony that that the urn was actually made in South Korea. And so I lifted it up and it spilled on him.
So I kept trying to put myself in Ryan Seacrest's shoes because it was a very funny stunt. And at the same time, I was thinking, like, God, this is like his big night. It's almost like, you know, in the movie Carrie when she's like, she's finally like, she's prom queen. They like her after all. And then she has the pig blood spilled on her. Did you worry that, like, you were going to ruin his night and maybe the flower wasn't going to come out of the jacket and he'd have to be on, like, global television with a stained jacket for the rest
of
the evening?
I think that's why it was flour rather than something that could stain, and that's why it was something that you could really brush off. And also, that's also the reason, you know, I was, you know, sitting with my co-writer and we were saying, you know, who do we spill it on? And we only came up with the idea the night before. And, you know, we thought, you know, do we do it on Clooney or Brad Pitt? And I thought, no, we can't do it on them because that really is their big night. You know, that is, you know, Hollywood is celebrating them for the, you know, their achievement in movies. You know, really the journalists on the red carpet are just there to, you know, talk about what suit you're wearing and what, you know, and promote various fashion labels. So to cover a suit that was given by a fashion label with a bit of flour that could be brushed off, we thought wasn't really such a terrible thing. And also after the actual event, I sent him a new jacket that was identical, with a little label inside which said made in the Republic of Wadia by child slave labor.
Any regrets about anything that you've done in character that looking back you think did cross a line and was maybe like hurtful in a way you didn't want to be or inappropriate in a way that you didn't expect it to be?
There's always a discussion before anything is done. It's, you know, me and my co-writer, or, you know, there can be co-writers, and we sit around and discuss the morality of a particular act. You know, is the subject worthy of, you know, having an hour of their time wasted? Or, and if something worse is happening, you know, then, you know, for example, the hunters in Arkansas, when I'm Bruno and I'm coming on to them, you know, and being flirtatious with them, which really isn't such a terrible thing. If a woman was being flirtatious with a man, I don't think a man would get extremely upset. He might blush. But so there was no real logical reason why a man being flirtatious with another man should get a man incredibly upset, unless that the subject exhibited some deep-rooted homophobia. So, you know, when it's something like that, we do always question the morality. And, for example, if a woman was pregnant, or, you know, there was somebody who was poor, or somebody who is undeserving, you know, I'm certainly much more reluctant to do anything, and those people would be ruled out. And, you know, if you look at the Ali G show and you look at generally the people who I interview, they tend to be white, wealthy, powerful males, you know, in positions of extreme influence.
Well, Sacha Baron Cohen, it's been great to have you back. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me back. Thank you for letting me speak for so long.
Sacha Baron Cohen speaking with Terry Gross. He co-wrote and stars in the new movie, The Dictator. John Fulbright is a young Oklahoma singer-songwriter who's just released his first studio album called From the Ground Up. Raised in Woody Guthrie's hometown of Okemah, Oklahoma, Fulbright's been the opening act for performers as various as Jimmy Webb and Joe Ely, and rock critic Ken Tucker says he's more than ready for headliner status.
This is not reflection. Reflection is true. This is just me. Me wanting you. Sweet silver memories.
John Fulbright's voice rises up and around the guitar chords on that song, Me Wanting You, his tone intended to haunt the person he's addressing. His desire, his me wanting you, is as direct as he can possibly make it. It's not a cry of despair or hope or lust. It's the sound of someone intent on making as strong a connection with the listener as he possibly can.
6 long days, 7th day he rested, said there's one sure way humans can be bested, give them wine and song, fire and lust, when it all goes wrong, I'm the man to trust, and now you're on my own, all mine together, will you sing my praise, sing my name forever, I am God above, Lord.
For a guy who's not yet 25 years old, Fulbright sounds as though he's lived through a lot, or at least thought it through. Speaking in the voice of God, as he does on that song called God Above, Fulbright doesn't seem like a callow youth overreaching for profundity. Here and on other songs on the appropriately titled From the Ground Up, Fulbright is building the foundation for his method. Acoustic guitar and piano mostly, with vocals that are conversationally inflected, whenever they don't build into a strangled yowl. And occasionally, he'll work an actual hook into a song if it doesn't strike him as unseemly.
Old man broke down on the side of the road. Stop and see if maybe I can lighten his load. Well, he opened the door and he thanked me in kind. Told don't worry about gasoline, 'cause we're moving. Don't worry about the TV screen, 'cause we're moving. Don't worry about the bombs that fall, 'cause we're moving. Don't worry about nothing at all, 'cause we're moving.
The limitation of sparsely arranged material like this is that it can rely too heavily on words, lyrics that don't hold up to close philosophical or metrical scrutiny. There's a bit of that here, most notably in Fulbright's game but thin variation on early period Randy Newman called Fat Man. And speaking of Randy Newman, Fulbright could use more humor. But there's no doubt that he's an up-and-comer moving in the right direction. It's a good sign when you get 11 cuts into an album and the quality remains high, as it does with Daydreamer.
Young men spend a lot of time looking down at the ground, looking down when they pray, looking down every day. Dreamers know that the finer things wait up in the air. The young men are proud. Sometimes dreaming ain't allowed. Dream me.
There's an unassuming sureness to John Fulbright's best songs. He's an Oklahoma kid who's not pushing his oaky authenticity down your ears. Instead, he already knows how to pull back, to establish a mood, and then fill it in with details both verbal and musical that draw you into his world and make you momentarily forget your own.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed John Fulbright's new album From the Ground Up. Coming up, actor and comedian David Alan Greer talks about performing in the new Broadway revival of Porgy and Bess. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
I only pray at night when the world disappears, put away and out of sight, I confront my fear.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, David Alan Greer, is nominated for a Tony for his performance as the drug dealer and pimp Sportin' Life in the Broadway adaptation of the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess. Porgy and Bess premiered on Broadway in 1935 and was written by Ira and George Gershwin and Dubose Hayward, who wrote the novel and the original play. The new production is set in the late 1930s on the South Carolina coast in the fictional place Catfish Row. Terry spoke with David Alan Greer last week. Greer first became known for his work on the variety and comedy TV show In Living Color, where his characters included the blues singer Calhoun Tubbs and Antoine Merriweather, the co-host of Men on Film with Damon Wayans. Greer got his start on Broadway, starring in a musical about Jackie Robinson, which got him his first Tony nomination. His second was for his performance in the David Mamet play Race. Terry began with a track from the new cast recording of Porgy and Bess. Sportin' Life is trying to convince Bess to leave Catfish Row and Porgy and go with him to New York.
Days a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me, that's where you belong. You and me can live that high life in New York. Come with me, there you can't go wrong, sister. You buy you the swellest mansion up on the upper Fifth Avenue. And through Harlem you go strutting, you go a-strutting, and there'll be nothing too good for you. You'll dress the rich in silks and satins, just like the pair of stylers. And all the blues you'll be forgetting, there'll be no fretting, just nothing but smiles. Come along with me, that's the place, don't be a fool. Come along, come along. There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me.
David Alan Greer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Really loved your performance on the show. You know, I interviewed Audra McDonald recently about playing Bess, and she said that, you know, she always loved the song There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York as a song, as a, just an independent song, and always thought, oh, it's about this guy who's inviting a woman to go to New York and lead a more glamorous life. He wants to buy her things. Isn't that great? But hearing it in the show, you know, this guy's really trying to seduce her into a life of prostitution and drug addiction. Yeah. He wants to be her pimp and control her. Did the meaning of the song change for you when you joined the cast and started singing the song?
Absolutely. My relationship to Porgy and Bess coming into this production was one of, I've never seen the opera. I have sketches of the movie in my head. So remembering those patches of the movie as a child, I thought Happy Dust was like fairy dust. You know, like, is he a magician, Sportin' Life? Is he, what, you know, what exactly is he doing? Because I was too young to really understand who and what this man was, this character was.
Can I production. Just back up and say that Happy Dust is the name in the opera for what I assume is cocaine.
Right, right.
So I said I assume Happy Dust was cocaine. Maybe it's heroin. Does it make a difference to you which it is? Do you need to know?
We decided that it is cocaine. Now, you know, we decided as a production because that's, you kind of have to go like, what is this? Are we all on the same page? Yeah, I think so. I mean, in 1935, the source material, I would assume it's cocaine. I mean, and I also think that for Sportin' Life, the cocaine is really a tool. I mean, I think he is a purveyor of flesh. I mean, I think that is what gets him off. That is really his interest in Bess. And the cocaine is a way to make money and exploit her weakness, but it's all used to get her, to seduce her, to get her so that I can turn her out. I mean, that's really what's happening.
So, you know, you're a comedian, and among other things, and you know, sport life is, you know, usually played as somebody both sinister but really kind of like dapper with a comedic side to him. How have you tried to balance the sinister and the comedic in your performance?
I didn't want to play it on one level, meaning I didn't want to hit the stage like, you know, Snidely Whiplash going, you know, I have this, you know, this drug, you take it and we'll go to New York. It was more smooth and trying to build a real seduction, which is he comes on, he's funny, amusing, always there. And as the stakes change, his argument changes. The way he talks to Bess when no one else is around is different than when he talks to her with the community around. I think Sportin' Life is a salesman, so he has to be flamboyant, the life of the party. He's really fun to hang out with, but you just don't want to owe him any money. Because once you get on that side of him, he changes. So to try and build it and put all those levels in so that it builds and changes and evolves all the way leading to that moment of there's a boat where he just drops all facade and goes for her because they're alone on stage and no one else is there, then he can show his real face.
What meaning did Porgy and Bess have for you when you were growing up? How aware of it were you?
I you know, this whole production has been so strange. I was talking to my brother, my older brother, about Porgy and Bess. When we first started, we did a workshop in New York, and he said, "Well, you know, Dad was obsessed with Porgy and Bess," and I'm like, "What?" I'm the youngest of three kids, so I'm 55 now. Which means when the movie came out, I was really little. I was like, what, 3 years old? So I don't have any memory of it. I've never seen the opera. And he goes, oh yeah, when the movie came out, Daddy came, you know, home with posters, and he, and through our correspondences, he talked about all these other productions that he'd seen, the opera, and who's playing Bess, and how are we doing it differently? I mean, he was all involved.
Was it a relief to know that your father loved Porgy and Bess? And here's why I ask. Your father is the co-author of a very important, widely read book called Black Rage, which was published in 1968. And it's all about all of the issues like, you know, slavery, oppression, discrimination that held back and pushed down African Americans, and what the source of that day's anger was. And some people see Porgy and Bess as being stereotyped. Some people see it as being this, like, extraordinary achievement that gave both a Broadway stage and an opera stage to African Americans who would have never gotten such fantastic roles before.
Right.
So did you know how your father, like, in those two?
I didn't. I didn't know all of that. Because that was the conversation, that's the exact conversation we had when he finally was able, we was well enough to travel to see the production. We went out for lunch, and I said exactly that. I didn't know your relationship to Porgy and Bess, if you felt it was racist or if you felt this was a great American opera, blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he was like, this is, you know, America's greatest opera. Are you kidding me?
Stephen Sondheim wrote a very famous and controversial letter about your production of Porgy and Bess before it even started previewing. It was a letter that was published in the New York Times in reaction to a feature story that quoted Diane Poulos, the director, Suzanne Laurie Parks, who did the adaptation of the book, and Audra McDonald, who plays Bess. And based on what they said, based on the revisions that they said they wanted to make, Stephen Sondheim was outraged that they thought they could improve on what the Gershwins and Dubose Heywood originally came up with. And I could see how that might be very demoralizing for the cast and producers, writer, director, etc. So I read in the Times that you really helped boost everybody's spirits. If that's true, what did you do?
Well, I came in and I said, now listen. I don't know who this Steven Soderbergh is, but I've never liked his films, and I didn't even know he's an opera fan. So I told Audra that, and she fell out laughing. And so that's what I said, basically.
Did it get you down?
Listen, I'm going to be honest. I read it first thing in the morning. That's what I do. I read the New York Times. And I was titillated and excited because I will tell you why. That is what theater is supposed to do. I didn't think people would get this excited and heated over a simple musical production. I want to be in that production. You know what I'm saying? The comments were, I think there were like 400 comments, people going back and forth. At the end of the day, it was a letter in response to an article about a production that no one had seen and had not even opened. So at the end of the day, I felt confidence in what we were doing. Okay? Nobody's seen it. Come see it and then make an opinion.
I wonder if Sondheim's seen it.
I don't know, but one time I thought I saw him.
Really?
I'm just kidding. Yeah. There was a joke, like every so often in the beginning, we'd be there and some one of us would mutter to the other during a curtain call, "Steven's out there. I think I saw him." Yeah. I don't know if he has.
So an In Living Color question. I honestly, and this might be an embarrassment to admit, but the first time I heard Snaps was in your sketch, Men on Film, which I'm going to ask you to describe and also ask you to describe where the snaps came from.
All right. Well, we would rate, Damon and I would rate, Blaine and Anton, we would rate movies using snaps.
And this is Damon Wayans, one of the stars.
Right,
the
right, right. Yeah. The fun of In Living Color was exposing black culture, and in particular in that sketch, gay culture that I don't think America had ever seen at that point. I had already done Dreamgirls and on Broadway, you know, and being in a musical and working with other performers who were gay, I was privy to that vocabulary backstage. It was, you know, they were being themselves. So a lot of it was hijacked from what I heard in the theater and what was permeating around. So the snap thing was, if at the time, you know, if a gay person, a gay man were going to read you, it always came, reading meaning tell you off, it was accompanied by snaps. Now, I don't know if it was, it became a gay thing, but it's also a very black thing, and I'll tell you. So in other words, it was like, "Terry, I don't like your show." That's how it was told. You understand?
Yes.
"Don't call me." You know, stuff like that. Or they would go, "No, I don't like you." And they would put a snap on it. So that's where it came from.
And explain how you'd use it in Men on Film.
Well, we would go, you know, we would review a movie and we'd say, "We give this two snaps in a, you know, in a Z formation." And we would make it up on the spur of the moment to, you know, rate these movies. But I have a quick story I got to tell you.
Please.
Race. David Mamet's Race. There was one performance of Race where my character comes out and he says, "You know, sit down. You know, you want to tell me about black folks?" To Richard Thomas, who's white and privileged. I begin to, you know, spew this monologue. This particular performance, every time I would say, "You want to tell me about black folks?" I hear this in the audience. "You can't tell me about black folks. Why? Because you're white." And it was like every point I made, somebody in the audience was going, "Mm-hmm." So it was pretty funny, and we were laughing. It was like that person was mic'd. Yeah, it was pretty funny.
Well, David Alan Greer, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Now, wait, did I answer all your questions?
Well, here's one that I thought of asking you that I didn't ask.
Right.
This gets back to your father again. Mm-hmm. So your father is a psychiatrist.
Right.
He taught at the college level. Did you feel like he was, that he had these like special insights into your mind because he was a psychiatrist when you were growing up? That he was, a lot of kids feel like their parents are kind of omniscient. Did you feel that any more so because he was a psychiatrist?
Listen, if you're asking me, did he ever pull the psychiatrist thing with me? No. Why would you say that, Terry? And how were you feeling when David said that to you? I'd like to hear your thoughts. No, he was a father. You'd sit down and stop fidgeting. That's very unpsychiatric. But I will tell you this. My father has always been very intimidating. And I'll tell you what. I was doing Shakespeare in the Park with Charles Dutton, well-known actor, spent time in prison. Nobody should intimidate him. He was there, and I introduced him to my father, and he walked away, and he went, man, that dude is really intimidating. Because he is. He just has that. He's the smartest man I know, and it was more that, to try and live up to what he'd done and to impress him in his eyes. And quick story. My father has been very ill.
He was
not able to travel to see Race, which I know he would have loved. Why? Because I was a screaming black man. He would have loved it. He finally came to see Porgy and Bess. And I asked Audra and Norm to come out. As they came out, my father grabbed Audra's hand and just began to weep. Members of the company that I'd asked came out and surrounded him and hugged him. And he kept telling Audra, you have made my life so rich. So it was a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I'm so glad that he got a chance to see Porgy and Bess.
That's really great. It was really great. I'm glad he got to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me too.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
David Alan Greer speaking with Terry Gross. Greer plays Sport and Life in the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess and has been nominated for a Tony. The new cast recording was released this week. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by an environmentally dedicated young feminist played by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.